fear has always been the governing principle of my life. But now, it is gone.
Stardate 97949.6. Welcome back to Star Trek Discovery Pod, the number one podcast about shedding your threat ganglia and becoming the badass bitch you were always meant to be. My name is Mike Moody. With me on the view screen is...
Mariah Gossett.
Grant Davis.
Clyde Haynes.
This week, we're talking Star Trek Discovery again.
Yay!
In anticipation of Season 3 of Discovery, dropping sometime in our lifetime, maybe, hopefully,
please,
someday. Today, we're discussing Saru, breaking down his character arc, sharing our opinions, and diving into what some of you, our listeners, have to say about the first Kelpian in Starfleet, played by the incomparable Doug Jones.
But folks, before we go ahead and dive into this deep and thrilling, dare I say, Saru talk, a quick reminder to all of you guys that if you're listening to this and you haven't already done it, hit that subscribe button. It only takes you a second, and it's a good reminder every time we put out new content. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you guys are listening to us. And while you're at it, go ahead and give us that 5-star review. That really does help us out. Maybe kind of trivial for you, but it definitely helps us in the rankings and visibility and our reach. And for all the links to Apple and Spotify, YouTube, etc., you can just go visit our website, StarTrekPod.co.
And if you all would like to hear more of our voices and more of what we have to say about Trek, make sure you visit patreon.com/StarTrekPod. Right now, Mike and I have been doing a Best of 7 series where we're talking about 7 of 9. We just watched the episode where she fights with the Rock, and so we'll be discussing that later this week. It's a great episode. It was super fun. We're also covering the original series films, so if you'd like to hear our opinions on all of that, make sure you go to patreon.com/StarTrekPod. And if you join at the $2 per episode level, you get into our Slack channel where you can hang out with us, talk all things Trek. There's academic papers, there's talks about books, there's watch along parties. It's a great time.
Yeah. And if you want to hang out with us on Twitter, check us out at Star Trek Pod. That's at Star Trek Pod on Twitter. Please tweet about the episodes. Let people know. Can I get the word out? If you like what you hear, share and become part of our community.
Sharing is caring.
So this week's episode of the pod is a little different. If it's your first time listening, typically what we do is review episodes of Star Trek Discovery and episodes of Star Trek Picard during their latest seasons. But during the off season, we like to cover the shows in different ways. And today we're continuing a series discussing the arcs of some of our major characters on Discovery. So 2 weeks ago, we dedicated a full episode to Michael Burnham. You can find that at StarTrekPod.co or wherever you get podcasts. And this week, it's all about Saru, one of my favorite characters on Disco. Maybe my favorite character, actually. Where does Saru rank for you guys?
I mean, definitely my top 5.
You mean like favorite character of all characters ever or like Trek-wise?
Of all characters, including real-life people.
Oh, man.
Shit. Whoa. I thought we were just talking about on Disco.
I mean, I like him, but he's not on the list.
I mean, there's Jesus and then Saru for me.
Top two. Damn.
Dang.
Flip the order. He's also a messiah figure. So.
Well, let's talk about between him and Michael Burnham. I love Michael Burnham, but I really find Saru's arc, I think I relate to it more.
Yeah. I really like Saru. I think Saru and Burnham make each other better characters on the show for their relationship makes their characters better. And so I think they are very intertwined just in the way that their arcs have been built and they are learning from each other. And we'll, you know, kind of get into, you know, more things about Saru. But my final like thought about Burnham before we move into that is, while this is a show where she is not the captain as the main character, she's definitely the captain of the cast. You know, I got more time on my hands, so I've been watching lots of nerd YouTube lately, and was watching one from the Star Trek website where they were talking about how Sonequa Martin-Green, as soon as the casting was done, would plan like game nights and dinners and all of these things for the whole cast to bond, because I think she knows that the more that the cast is close and bonded and it feels like a family, that in real life that's going to come across on the screen. And so, you know, hats off to Sonequa Martin-Green.
That's what I've been trying to institute with us, and no one will hang out with me.
It's you, Grant.
I'll hang out on a viewfinder with you anytime, Grant.
Whatever. I hate all of you guys. Friction.
I retweet you sometimes.
I don't know. Saru and Burnham, I think from the very beginning, I've been a Burnham fan. I wasn't so sold on Saru. Like I said, I like him. I'm not sure if he's in my top three on Discovery. So it's interesting in that way. But I do think his character arc has probably come further than just about anyone else on the show.
I mean, yeah, he's a fascinating character, I think, because he starts from a position where, like, yeah, he's a high-ranking officer in Starfleet. But at the same time, they've already established that this guy has a lack of confidence, a big fear issue, and that is notorious among his species. They are a bit more timid. They don't have that certain element that one needs for leadership. And so you can already see these restraints put on the character, and it's a stumbling block for his development. And as we've seen through the development of the character through the two seasons, he's shed a lot of that physically, even, and been able to metamorphosize, that's not the word, into a stronger, more capable character. And it's I think it's really well done. And it is, like you were saying, Mike, one of the better arcs in the show.
Yeah. Just to piggyback on what you were saying, Saru's arc really encapsulates for me a great Star Trek tradition. So he's a Kelpian. He's the first of his species to join Starfleet, and he's the first Kelpian we've ever seen on Star Trek. He was a brand new character to Trek fans when he was introduced in Discovery's first season. He's part of a great long-running tradition in Trek. In most Star Trek series, especially in DS9 and sometimes TNG, members of alien races were often introduced with like stereotypical base traits. You know, the Ferengis were greedy and rude, the Cardassians were space Nazis, but at its best, Trek allowed these alien characters to grow and develop and become rich, fully realized individuals that break out of those stereotypical roles and find empowerment in their individuality. And that's exactly what has gone on with Saru. The character arc is just a great picture of what Starfleet does best. They start out with these base traits of these new alien species, and they take one character, and we get to sit back and watch them evolve. And that's what they've done with Saru. And it's a wonderful picture of the one of the great things Star Trek does.
It was also pretty brilliant on their part to establish. I imagine there's books of all these characters, all these aliens that have been already established in this world. And it's hard to just thread that needle and just introduce a new one. And why haven't we seen it before? But I thought it was pretty brilliant that they said the Kelpians are they're an agrarian, undeveloped civilization. That's why we haven't seen him elsewhere. He is this outcast, this outlier from the rest of them, who was able to escape his planet, but only him. While the rest of his species, his people, are essentially slaves on this planet. It actually reminds me a lot of, did you guys ever play Abe's Odyssey, the video game on PlayStation?
No.
It was a fun game that had aliens that looked a lot like the Kelpians, and they're slaves at this like meatworking factory for these other aliens, and Abe's this one alien who's trying to escape and then free the rest of his people. And it so parallels the Saru story. I mean, also similar to like Anakin Moses. Or Luke Skywalker or Moses, the slave who leaves and comes back to free his people, which we see in season two. I mean, it's a lot of just these classic, powerful archetype storytelling devices that are loaded into this kind of unassuming character. I mean, he's very eye-catching in his makeup and his mannerisms, but his personality isn't the boldest on the screen, which makes him that understated element and just makes him all the more powerful as he continues to grow in the background and then just become the force that he is.
Yeah, I like the idea that he is such an ambitious outlier. Like in the Short Trek, which it wasn't my favorite Short Trek, the Saru-centric one, but even though I like spending time with the character, it wasn't a great Short Trek, but it kind of...
We shat
on it really bad.
Yeah, you did.
But it had a great sequel in the season two episode in which Saru liberates his people from the Ba'ul. So all that setup was necessary for that episode to really work, and it worked really well. So Saru was always an outlier among his people. Like he, not only did he long to explore the stars, but he questioned the very foundation of his society. So not only was he the only one questioning what was going on, he was the first one to say, without a lot of contemplation, like, I have a chance to get out of here and I might never come back. Yeah, I'm going to do that. That just, I mean, we see a lot of stories like that. But for me, that just reminds me of growing up in a small town and being like, I'm going to get the fuck out of here and I'm never coming back. And then last year, I went home and I saved my town from an alien species. It was fucking amazing. Dang. Yeah.
Through a dance-off competition.
But no, I mean, I really relate to that sentiment. And I don't know, just even though that Short Trek we saw about his background or his backstory wasn't super compelling, what they did with it in season two with that foundation with his character was great.
Yeah, I actually thought that the Short Trek helped me quite a bit in kind of, I don't know, identifying a little bit more with Saru. Because before that, I'm expecting the number one to be a little bit more kind of compelling. I think Star Trek has toyed with this idea of really being kind of a space Western from time to time, where you have these kind of cowboy-like characters, right? Like when you think about Shatner or Riker, and then that typically is the archetype that is kind of held up, right? So there's always this character that you kind of like, and ultimately everybody else is trying to be a little bit more like that. And Saru just wasn't like that at all. And I was trying to figure out, like, why am I following him? What do I like about him? Uh-oh, Grant's going to disagree. Yes!
Well, here's what I'm going to disagree. Spock. Isn't Spock much more like Saru in that he is alien? He's a little bit different than everyone else that was on the ship. He's much more scientifically minded and a little bit more of a square. Like Shatner or Kirk is the one who's like going in and wanting to punch and start the action.
Yeah.
And Spock is the one who's like, let's hold back and let me be a nerd about all of this. And isn't that essentially what Saru is as well? Sure, he's not the leader, but he's a great number one in the same vein as what Spock was.
So I'd say it's a little different in that. So one, when I look at Spock feels like a cowboy. There's a cowboy inside of him trying to get out. Right?
But was that apparent at the beginning, or did that cowboy have to be fleshed out over seasons?
Well, but I also think the issue with Spock is playing like the counterpart to this magnificent kind of Kirk character, right? Like there is this dynamic. where Saru, because of circumstance, for a while, it just felt like he was the one that was lifted up. And it just, that was, I was struggling with that, right? So I think if it was different. And so in the very beginning, in the pilot, where we're seeing that Burnham is kind of like this key character and Saru's playing off of her, that felt normal to me. That felt like that worked, right? But then once it was flipped and Saru is the kind of above Burnham, I'm like, but Burnham's the hero.
Right. I get the problematic nature of once he kind of assumed the commander role, and I think us, the audience, intentionally so, we're not behind him. I think like how it ends in the first season with him just by default kind of taking over that role, they recognized already and already had in the plans that he was just a temporary acting captain and they were going to bring another confident leader in Pike to juxtapose that kind of relationship, just as they did with him and Lorca. Like, Lorca is the Kirk kind of character who has that confidence, and he's the and Saru's the chief science officer who got promoted to being the number one just by being the guy who learned like 94 languages or whatever they said he learned, and being the guy who like is a like living C-3PO who's just able to be that right hand man who knows everything that you need. You need the references to.
Going back to the Spock illusion, I do find similar character traits with Saru and Spock. However, their journey and their personal growth, they're on such different tracks. And it's great because with Spock, Spock is learning to tap into his humanity throughout the entire series and throughout all the movies. And that's the character arc of Spock, largely. But with Saru, we don't have a repeat of that because we had a repeat of that already with Data, who has a very similar character arc to Spock. On TNG, Data was always trying to tap into this humanity. And then we also had a similar thing with Seven of Nine, who's a great character, but her whole arc on Voyager was about getting back in touch with her humanity. So I'm glad we have a Spock-like character who is cautious and intellectual and not a bruiser like Kirk or Lorca. But Saru is on his own journey. His arc was far more personal and a bit of a deviation than just tapping into some kind of humanity. He wasn't this unemotional being. He had a lot of emotions, and his emotions typically are what stifled him. He was pulled back by this fear. His whole species lives with fear. The moment they're born, he says, we all live with fear the moment we're born, and we're basically afraid and nervous all the time. And throughout the first season, Saru is characterized as this cautious crew member. And as viewers, we see this as a natural character trait of his species, who are always fearful and always alert, and they act like prey. But as the series grows on, he grows and becomes much more three-dimensional. And I find it to be very rich and compelling.
Yeah, I was watching an interview with Doug Jones, who plays Saru, talking about how he came up with the movements for him and sort of the way he was going to portray the character. And I think it speaks to how important like whole production crews are to the success of a series, because he said the first thing he saw were the shoes. So those like hoof-like shoes, which dictated to him how Saru was going to walk, which is that like the arms through the back where the hips are forward. Very, he called it like supermodel of the world sort of walk. But he says through the first season and a half, Saru is walking like a supermodel, but doesn't believe he's hot. And then once the ganglia fall, he knows he's hot shit. And he gets to like kind of fully portray his supermodel self. So I thought that was such an interesting thing to hear from him about how he even like that twist of the ganglia was even a huge surprise to him because he had sort of figured out a way to portray this character who is, he said, is almost like butler-like, you know, is always sort of standing with one arm kind of in front of him and one behind, like ready for a bow because it's like so reverent to leadership and to Starfleet, like is so dedicated to the crew, to their captain, like is so ride or die for everything. And then as soon as those ganglia fall out, it's less like bow pose and more like shoulders back, arms back, chest forward. Like I'm ready to take on everything.
Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah. Like gonna go strut down the street. And now like here's pre-adolescent Saru. And I remember we talked a lot about that during season two, and we were like, oh, post-puberty Saru is angry. You know, there's those moments where you finally got to see him like talk down to Pike and like really stand up for himself. So I'm really interested in what they're going to do with his character into season three as this confidence takes over. And I'm wondering if through this newfound confidence, we'll be able to see more of this potential captain leadership quality and less of this, I'm the nerd who got straight A's at the academy, and that's why I've been able to rise through the ranks because you cannot touch my intelligence level.
Yeah, I love that you bring up his fluid movements. The way Doug Jones plays it, his movements are so fluid, and I think that really parallels the character arc because a character who's described as extremely cautious and fearful and then all of a sudden gains this perspective where he is imbued with all this confidence, that could seem really jarring. But that character arc for me was really fluid. And I think they, you know, if you're looking at an episode list and you're like, okay, here's the episode in season two where Saru, his ganglia falls off and he becomes a super confident person. And all these other episodes, he wasn't. But if you go back and you watch those episodes, he was strong-willed and brave to begin with, but in a quiet way. Like, he displayed bravery even before losing the threat ganglia and transcending into a more confident person. He was
right.
He was the first of his kind to leave his home planet and join Starfleet. He put himself in potential danger because Starfleet is like the most dangerous job you can get. And he did that in order to be part of an organization dedicated to helping others. He states that in the first season. And we also see Saru, there's that episode in season one with the Povins, and they had that those influence, they influence his feelings and actions. And he has that absence of fear. And for the first time, we see his capability to be this brave, strong, driven, confident and dangerous individual. Like it's all
he became there. Like a dangerous predator.
Exactly. In that episode. Yeah, it's all there. So when he finally does emerge and evolve into this character who can stand on his own two feet and inspire his whole race, it doesn't feel jarring or out of nowhere. The seeds were there all along.
Yeah, they definitely showed that he had a strong will and a strong degree of ambition early on. There's that conversation. I don't remember what episode it was, but he was there where he was kind of confronted with like his problems of being timid, him wanting to assume a more leadership role, but kind of recognizing that he had these inhibitions in his character, which were getting in the way. And that proved that like he still did aspire to a captain role, a leadership role, and knew the elements that he needed to work on. So when the story kind of progressed to this point where he now was able to go through this transformation, shed the ganglia, which were a physical barrier to him being this more powerful character and this truer leader in the sense. It's interesting what you were talking about, Mike, about the character of Spock, because I think Spock is searching for the human side of himself. I think a lot in those episodes and in the movies, there's this exploration of his humanity. He's well acquainted with his Vulcanism, but getting acquainted with his humanity is definitely informed by the crew around him. who are primarily humans. And being around them helps him get in touch with that. But with Saru, he's a Kelpian who now, I mean, he was a Kelpian who was away from his people and didn't have a frame of reference for how a Kelpian should be among these other people. But even more so now that he's shed his ganglia, he's crossed a Rubicon into a realm that the rest of his people don't even know how to be, how to accept what he is becoming. And I think that's really fascinating for a third season. I mean, whether or not, like Mariah saying, that this is going to kind of follow the post-pubescent jokes we were making to him being a little bit irritable or too cocky, or if he is going to age with a degree of grace into just this assuredness of who he is. I mean, they could go either way, and I'd in general be fine with it, but I think there's something a little bit richer to explore with him allowing the pendulum to swing a little bit to being too cocky and too abrasive initially, and he has to kind of pull back and recognize he's going through some mood swings.
You know, you bring up an interesting point, Grant, in that I'm curious as to what happens to the Kelpians kind of in the future, right? Because Saru basically left them at a moment where if he had gone back, he basically could have been Emperor Saru of the Kelpian Alliance. But
I come back to you as your king.
Pretty much. But I wonder now, like, he has ushered them into completely new era, right? And given them this truth that they haven't had before. I think it'll be interesting to see, well, okay, so now, you know, in the future, what does that look like? Like, did they grow and explore? I mean, I would imagine that has changed their entire history of their world. And so it makes me a little curious as to what happens.
I mean, can you imagine? It's one thing that, I think that his ganglia fell off and he never probably had time to communicate with his people, even though he was probably in communication with his sister at this point after the freeing of the people from Ba'ul. I don't think he had time to communicate with her. Hey, you know what? The ganglia can fall off and you can actually survive. And you can evolve into this other like level of life. You kind of level up. I don't think he got a chance to communicate that. So if they go through that experience on their own.
No, I think he did.
Yeah, I think he did.
Oh, did he?
Yep.
Yeah. When they go back to the planet, that's when he has his big fight with Pike, because he's essentially like, I have to go down there and tell them that they survive. What did he call it?
I remember what the name
Valhalla,
was.
Valhalla?
Yeah, something like that.
Baharis, something. They survive puberty. And he was Vaharel. Like, they have to know this, because if they don't, they're just going to keep sacrificing themselves to right. The Ba'ul. So that was like a very integral part to him returning to his planet and kind You're of having right. this standoff with Pike about it.
Right.
But do you think there's a chance that a few generations of this and no longer having this idea of living in fear, that the Kelpians could rise to be a little bit more of an alpha species in the realm? And maybe 1,000 years from now, when they've jumped into the future, we're going to see some?
That's what the Ba'ul were afraid of, because it's been over 1,000 years. It's established in that episode. It's been over 1,000 years since any Kelpian has been allowed to survive the Vaharal and transform into this more confident version of themselves. And they feared that if a whole race of Kelpians were able to evolve in this way, that their base trait would be anger and they'd be able to conquer other species and just throw balance off of course with the planet.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're wicked smart.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cause imagine like all of the generational knowledge that they've lost because everybody just like is slaughtered to the wolves essentially once they hit puberty. And so it's like if more of them survived. And so that's that's the whole reason, like, we advance as a human species in technology is we're all able to live longer and to, like, write books and have a way to transfer knowledge. And so without knowledge transfer happening, technology can't grow. And so that's why they've always been, a primitive, air quotes, species, is because they weren't able to grow any technology.
They just kelp. Sat around collecting kelp. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So do you guys think there's a good chance we're going to see Kelpians in the third season?
I think so. I, like Clyde said, I would really love to see or find out what happens with the Kelpians after 930 years of them awakening to their true life.
Are there any Ba'ul left?
Their true life
Probably
experience.
Not.
Yeah, did they conquer the Ba'ul? Are there any left? Did they tip into the danger zone and become an evil species like the Ba'ul thought they would? I would love to find out the answer to that.
Ah, that's so exciting. I hadn't even obviously you guys have thought about it a bit more than me. I'm like, oh, what? Cool.
I mean, we're going to need some new species and Kelpians aren't exactly new, but I mean, okay. So we got to think about this.
They'd be new to the dynamic, right?
What everybody wants to know is what happens to Earth or the Federation 1,000 years in the future, right? That's the big question. They're not going to give that to us early. So they've got to give other stuff. Now, they could create some new species and we'd all be like, great. But you've got a couple species that are ripe for, I don't want to say filler, but ripe for exploring that we would be interested in. And those are the Kelpians, right? Like whether or not they could be completely outside the Federation and be a story arc that is super interesting for us to kind of poke at, or they could be the dominant faction within the Federation. Like really anything is possible and they're right there. And they got the costumes and the makeup set, right? So you're all there. So I absolutely think we're going to see them. Yeah. If nothing else, they're going to give that to us while they're fending off our panicky advances for wanting to know what happened to Earth.
Yeah, that's a potential fertile ground. Like, what happened to the Kelpians? How is the way they evolved going to impact Saru after he skipped so many generations? Like, I can't wait to see him deal with that.
Oh, what if they, like, the Kelpians become just, like, total evil and are the ones who destroyed the Federation. Right. Like, could you imagine how hard of a blow that would be to Saru?
Yeah.
Oh, it'd be so emotionally devastating.
I think the other thing that would be really interesting, because I like where you're going, Mariah, is if that happens, what is Saru's place in their history, the folklore, right? I mean, we were joking before about Moses. That's like if Moses just showed up one day and was like, hey, I'm back.
You'd be, I gotta fix this shit again.
Yeah. I mean, but he could be this hero figure, right? Like a true hero figure to his people.
But isn't that Jesus?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Isn't it also Jesus?
I mean, that would be...
Sets us up and then goes...
Depends on which major religion you're talking about.
I gotta come back and fix this shit.
If we're talking baseline Christianity, they've really set it up for a Jesus returning story. Because
it's like the red angel and all of these, they're following the stars.
I mean, not just that. I mean, Saru came and showed them how to live and how to be. And then they did that. And potentially after he left, all these generations went by and potentially the Kelpians screwed it up like the humans have. And then they're waiting for the savior to come back and fix everything.
If these Kelpians are wearing red hats in the future, oh man.
I see where you're going, Mike. And you could think about the whole Valinor and the Gengli falling off as a rebirth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, there's the whole thing there. I mean, you could follow that line. I think what we're saying is this. It's going to be pretty cool if we can see the Kelpians in the role that Saru, who was this like mythical figure for them, who gave them knowledge and then literally disappeared for 1,000 years.
And Grant, # not all Christians. So
wait, what did I say?
The red hats.
That they're all going to be wearing red hats. Okay, so I want everybody's take on this. Do you guys think Saru is a good leader And would you accept him as captain of the Discovery in season 3?
I would accept him as the captain in season 3, but I don't think he's going to hold on to it forever. But I think he's going to, I think his character arc is going to get there. I just don't know if he is there yet, but I think he is a great number one, specifically because of his like knowledge, cool, calm, collectedness, and now his newfound confidence. And I think he just has to build that confidence so that the rest of the crew, I think the rest of the crew respects him, but I think there'd be more questioning of his decisions than I would see from someone I would consider a captain.
Yeah, because he's still very much, he's baking, right? He's still very much a character who's finding his way on the outside and inside more than anybody on the show.
I don't want to see him as captain. I think he might end up as captain, but I'm putting a time limit of 3 episodes on it. maybe 2, because usually these seasons aren't that long.
I love your time limits because they're always disappointing.
They're always disappointing. They're always disappointing. But I don't want to see him captain that long. And that could change, because what we're saying is the Saru that we know has like zero swag, right? Like he's got no mojo. But the new Saru might. And so I say 2 episodes, but I reserve the right to change my mind if new Saru comes in like a leather jacket and has got the swag.
I mean, their new outfits look pretty cool on the promos. He's going all like apocalypse wear.
And he's like, hey, Kayla, I'll holler at you later. Like, if that's the new Saru, then, I'm like, oh, this guy's got some confidence. He's moving in a different way.
Hyde Plains, write that fanfic for me. Saru, Kayla. No. Let's do it.
I mean, I'm definitely in the camp of, yes, I want to see him as captain for a bit. But I think story-wise, it makes more sense that we will see him in that captain role in the first few episodes. And we will see the problems and pitfalls that a person who, like I had already said, has had this sort of pendulum swing of confidence is going to overstep his boundaries of what a good leader should be. He's probably going to be a little bit too impulsive because he now doesn't really know how to balance himself chemically in this kind of switch. And if the stories are accurate about Kelpians being potentially dangerous when they lose their ganglia and have that kind of confidence, he's going to require a balancing force of the rest of his family aboard Discovery to kind of find that groove of where he needs to be. So I imagine it'll be this ownership of the captain role for a little bit. He has to step back away from it to kind of rediscover himself before he is at a position where he's going to be ideal for it. But I think eventually his path is that he will be a captain, not necessarily the captain for this show.
You know, it's interesting that I think we may be seeing a trend here, and that is we're getting glimpses of evil versions of all the potential captains of Discovery, right? We've seen evil Lorca. We've seen evil Giorgio. We've even seen evil Tilly, right? And some could...
Not evil Pike, my friend.
Not even Pike. But some could even argue that we've seen an evil version of Burnham when she tried to mutiny, right? So I think seeing an evil version of Saru could be fascinating and could be in line with what we're, we've seen so far.
I would like to see him, like you said, Grant, if he does get that captain leadership role, it would be compelling if he had to struggle with becoming who he's eventually going to become while in that leadership role. And
does someone have a ghost?
There's a ghost in my house. Yes. Can you hear that?
Okay. Yes.
It's really windy outside.
Apologies. Okay. I was like, What?
I was getting a little worried for somebody.
I'm so sorry.
I was thinking, I'm out of here. Some stuff starts moving.
It's just
around.
The way our building is positioned. Yeah. We always get this huge draft of loud wind. It's crazy.
All right.
Well, I think Saru is a great leader. I think he should be captain. And given, I agree with everything you guys said, especially Grant, but here's why I think he should be captain. Over the two seasons, we've seen him shed his fear to become this confident, powerful character, right? And one of the best things about Saru is at this point in the story, he's physically bigger and stronger than most of the characters on Discovery. And he's more confident than ever, but he's not super cocky and he's not an oppressive person because he knows what it's like to be oppressed in more than anybody there. So he has this great sense of empathy about him, and that combined with his self-empowerment is why I think he would make a great leader. And I mean, he already had the job and he did a good job. Like Saru was left in command of the Discovery in season one when Lorca and Michael went to the ISS Shenzhou in the Mirror U. And it was Saru's idea to have the Discovery pose as an ISS ship. So he saved them. It was his idea to dress up Tilly as Captain Killy, save them again. And he was in command of the Discovery in that big space battle against Lorca's ship at the end of season one. And he destroyed Lorca's ship and he saved Burnham from Lorca. And he was the one who figured out how to ride that shockwave to get everybody back home. So, and it was his speech to the crew about how he trusted them implicitly after everybody was rattled by Lorca's deception that rallied everybody together to fight and win that battle. So he's an inspiring character. And even when he had his threat ganglia, there were times when that Spidey sense saved the Discovery's ass several times. Like there was that one episode where Cornwallis, whatever her name is.
Cornball.
She is surprised by this Klingon attack on the starbase, but Saru saw it coming. So she is totally shocked and doesn't know what to do. And he takes over because she had come and taken over the ship from him. And in that moment, he takes over and he gets them out of there and he saves them again. So yeah, people look up to him. Tilly respects him. That's why she asked him to be her mentor for the Starfleet Command training program. And he leads the ship to victory again in the battle at the end of season two against the Section 31 drone fleet. Make this motherfucker captain.
Dang, Mike, why don't you just lead with that? I mean, that was a pretty compelling argument.
Yeah, way to make the compelling captain speech, Mike.
Yeah, I got chills.
You should have just led with that, and then we could all.
I wanted to see how you felt, and then I wanted
You wanted me to be wrong, is what you.
I wanted to spike the ball in your face. Yeah.
It makes, now that you've like put them all back to back to back like that, and then I just today rewatched the Orball for Sharon episode where he, even while dying, figures out what the orb wants in order to save the ship. Like, I guess he should be motherfucking captain. I agree now.
Hold up, guys. I still think there's something to be said for our gut instinct that three of us didn't really feel like he's fully earned it yet. And that's a product of the storytelling. I think that they still want us to be a little bit trepidatious about the idea of him sitting in the captain's chair. And it is, this is a guy who just went through another puberty that he does not have necessarily the tools and understanding to successfully navigate, especially on a ship that never has a therapist. And so what are we to expect, that he's just going to adapt to this new condition successfully without any sort of teenage angst?
Well, I
don't know.
I want to see a flawed leader that leads to compelling storytelling. So sure.
All right, fine.
I think
this has become debate club. Yeah. I'm really into this. Like,
I think part of the issue though is we're asking and answering this question, but the subtext is do we want him captain as long as they won't give us Burnham as captain? Right? I mean, am I the only one who ultimately, if you said you can make anybody on that ship captain, you'd be thinking I want it to be Burnham? Is that just me? Am I?
I think we talked about this with Burnham the other week, but I think I would love to see the series end with her getting the role of captain, either on that ship or a new ship, you know, and earning that, or turning it on its head and her becoming an admiral or something. But at this point, I think we even see it in the trailer for season 3. Saru is already the default captain here. Yeah. He's the highest ranking officer on the ship with Burnham gone.
And Burnham is, they've intentionally loaded her with a degree of baggage that they continue to kind of pull her away from the rest of the group and make her have her own kind of struggles, so that I think there's less of a jockeying for that command role, so that Saru will hold on to it for a bit. But I'm kind of with you, Clyde. I want her to have it because I feel like she, even more so than Saru, has repeatedly stuck her neck out, thrown her entire reputation on the line to save everyone. She does it time and time and time again, and still is relegated to kind of bearing this scarlet letter of mutiny and of this degree of distrust that she can't seem to shed despite saving the universe
again and again and again and again. Yeah. Okay. So here's what I think is going to happen. And this is kind of ties all these things together. We're going to want Burnham to be captain, but we know she's not even going to be on the ship for a while. Saru is going to step into that captain, even if it's informal kind of role. But again, I think the theme and what we're going to see, the trend over and over, is he's going to step up and it's going to be taken from him. And I think it's going to be taken from him by a character yet to be known, who is some person that is a high-ranking remnant of Starfleet that comes in and takes over as captain. And I would say for as many seasons as we get, we might be in for a revolving door of captain of the season.
Oh shit, is that David's great 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 grandson? Gerbilor Kirk?
What if it's just like Android Picard?
Oh no. Fuck. No, thank you. No, thank you.
That would be terrible, but fun. Yes. Like, that would be hilarious.
Excuse me, boy. I'm the captain now.
You know what? I think it would almost be worth it just to watch Star Trek fans go absolutely nuts.
Just to, like, instantly crap their pants upon that reveal.
Well, let's talk about Doug Jones a little bit. Is this Doug Jones' finest performance? Is this the one he'll be remembered for? He's played He played these iconic roles.
Talk.
Like the amphibian man in Shape of Water, which he doesn't really talk. He played Elfano and the pale man in Pan's Labyrinth. He does speak as Elfano. He played the Mac Tonight guy in those McDonald's commercials. Abe Sapien in Hellboy. He's done tons of other roles. But is this the one he's going to be remembered for?
It depends on the audience. I mean,
yeah.
I think overall this is his longest running like career as like a single character, and for that, sure, it should stand as his most iconic. As long as the success of this particular Trek series continues to grow, but I think that his role as the Fishman and Abe Sapien also kind of, he just has played a ton of really iconic characters, and he also played Silver Surfer.
That's right. I don't think he's ever going to live down being the fish who fucks in the Shape of Water. But
I mean, this should be his most, he's brilliant in this. Like the fact that he can put on that much makeup and show more emotion than half of the cast here. He's phenomenal. His body language, everything seems so considered in what he does and how he delivers his speeches, his mannerisms, how he interacts with everyone else in a scene. He's a large, imposing figure, and he knows how to make himself present or make himself small in order to build up other people around him. He's just a fantastic actor.
Yeah, I agree. I think the way he is able to emote through so much makeup, and I think it also, you know, like hats off to the makeup and costume department for being able to make what appears to be fairly lightweight and manageable prosthetics for him to wear to be able to actually emote through all of them. But I think it's his most compelling character because it's the one we've seen him play the longest, as you said, Grant. And then it's also the one where I think you get to see more of his face reacting and acting and less just his amazing body movements, which are what he's so well known for. The way he just totally adapts and becomes these new creatures no matter the project is astonishing. And like I was saying, the way that he is able to see what a creature concept looks like and come up with these subtle movements and ways to play the character is so fascinating and so interesting and so cool.
He knows his shit.
Yeah, I think I'm looking, you know, at his IMDb and it is crazy long.
Just a bunch of monster movies and shit.
Well, I mean, he was even like, in
iconic horror movies too. It's so great.
He was also monster in like Batman Returns. And
one of the Penguins guys.
He was a thin clown. But the reason why I'm looking at it is because I'm looking and going, if you think about the work he's done, how does it kind of stack up? And I keep coming back to this one thing. This is the biggest franchise that he's been a part of, right? Now, if you look at kind of The Shape of Water, it was kind of really recognized as kind of high art. And that's interesting. But I think at the end of the day, from a franchise, this is the biggest franchise he's been a part of. And as such, this, I think, is what he'll be remembered for, right? And the truth is, I'm looking at all this stuff and I'm like, I had no idea he was in that. I had no idea he was in that. We all know who Doug Jones is now, right? And even if you look at The Shape of Water, I don't know if you're really looking going, oh man, yeah, that's Doug Jones. But in this, we see him and it's him.
And you hear him.
You hear his voice. You see he's brought so much to it. I think this franchise is, especially if it goes the way it's set to go, this is going to be his defining kind of role.
Going back to the captain thing, Trek Movie did an interview with Doug Jones that dropped yesterday, and they asked him specifically about the captain's chair in season 3. And he said, he talks a lot about him and Burnham kind of jockeying for the captain's chair. And he said, we had Captain Pike all of season 2. He had to return to the Enterprise, but even before he left, he told Saru, let's discuss the captain's chair. And at some point, I intimated we needed to go through this particular battle we were facing with Control and make the jump and do all that. And then we can talk about the captaincy later, because there are many things to consider. And in that scene, I threw a glance over to Burnham and she threw a glance back and we have an understanding. It is either going to be her or me, probably. We are both capable. Who is going to get it is, again, a mystery that comes in season 3. So they're aware that we're wondering who's going to be the captain.
She ain't even on a ship, so...
Oh, she's getting back on that ship in
episode 3. Yes.
Episode
well, okay, three. I want to say this other thing, because I've been thinking about this a little bit, what we were talking about. I think what we're seeing about Doug Jones is he's going, whether he wants this to be his defining role, and even more so if he does become captain, but he's going to fall in line with all the other Star Trek actors who have a long list of credits, but because of the particular role they play, especially if it's they have prosthetics on, right? Michael Dorn has done a bunch of things, but he'll always be Worf. Brent Spiner will always be Data. LeVar Burton has had like four careers.
Tell that to Professor X. I said, tell that to Professor X.
Well, here's the thing. And you look at Jean-Luc Picard. He's had a number of shows. X-Men is great. I'm a big X-Men fan. But if you tallied up what people know him as, I promise you, number one, it's going to be Jean-Luc Picard. Like,
especially because you didn't even call him Patrick Stewart. You just called him Jean-Luc Picard.
Exactly. See, it's a that ingrained.
You're saying Doug Jones is Alan Rickman in Galaxy Quest.
I was really thinking he's more of Geordi. He's more of a LeVar Burton. Like, this is just what's going to stick with him, right? And don't get me wrong, I love some Reading Rainbow, but he is Geordi LaForge. So I see Doug Jones. This is going to be Doug Jones's legacy.
Do you think they're going to have a corny episode where Saru goes through some sort of machine that allows him to be human for an episode?
If we had 22 episodes, absolutely.
Don't they always do that in yes. Trek? Like, where all of a sudden Data's a human for this episode, so he doesn't have to wear the makeup or whatever.
They didn't do that. They just introduced a random brother that he had that was human. Okay, real quick. Do you guys have a favorite Saru episode or moment? Let's hear it.
I can go. I came across this quote and remembered how much I liked it, and it was from the third episode, The Brightest Star, and it was Saru saying, "I saw hope in the stars. It was stronger than fear, and I went toward it." And I was like, that was such a good line. It was him, you know, leaving the rest of his people behind in pursuit of hope for something more, something beyond everything that he had known thus far. And I thought, that's such a good line about aspiration and optimism.
Kind of along those lines, I actually, in his short trek, the moment where he interacts with Georgiou for the first time and realizes that this is it, this is the moment, this is when you get to, you know, you either jump or you fall, like, I thought that was such a wonderfully quiet moment, but so pivotal to his character arc, to kind of show us that even with the fear ganglia, he knew he was destined for more and that he was willing to take that risk.
Clyde?
Yeah, I'm gonna go two. So I think the short trek was important for me, because it gave me backstory, and I needed the backstory. It may not have been a great episode, but I needed to understand why I should care about Saru. And then I've been thinking about something that you alluded to earlier, Mike, and that was the speech he gave to the crew kind of before this big battle on the episode What's Past is Prologue. And he says, "It is well known that my species has the ability to sense the coming of death. I do not sense it today. I may not have all the answers. However, I do know that I am surrounded by a team I trust, the finest the captain could ever hope to command. Lorca abused our idealism. And make no mistake, Discovery is no longer Lorca's. She is ours. And today will be her maiden voyage. We have a duty to perform, and we will not accept a no-win scenario. You have your orders. On your way." That was pretty compelling. If I was ever going to become like a Saru full-on fan and go, "This is my captain," that was the moment.
Yeah, he paraphrases Kirk right there. No win scenario. Mm-hmm. Mariah, earlier you mentioned an obol for Charon, the season 2, episode 4. For me, the ending of that episode is what I think about when I think about Saru, when he's ready to die. And he's facing death with such dignity. And he shares that moment with Michael. And she's about to cut the ganglia off of him. And when they cut it, they die. But they just fall off into Michael's hands. and she realizes he's going to live, and he realizes he's going to live, and they start crying together. Damn, that's just a great moment.
It's so good. And y'all, get ready for me to be even more of a production nerd, because our TV died. Sad. Shed a tear for TV. But we got a new 4K TV, and I rewatched some Discovery today, and that shit looks so good. So when this new season comes out, whoo, production design crew, you're getting all the shout outs. Special effects, you're getting all the shout outs.
Does it look as good for you as Star Trek V, the production that you absolutely loved?
I still stand by that production design, the set design. I think it looked really cool.
That ping pong ball they painted as a spaceship and then just strung around space.
Yeah, I think Grant called it a sweeted Star Trek movie. real quick before we go, James Worm, one of our listeners, had some thoughts on Saru. He says, my top Saru moment was when he told Burnham he didn't trust her, that he laid it out, that she was responsible for all the death and destruction, and that her ongoing presence on Discovery and unwillingness to reconcile her actions are putting everyone in further danger. And it wasn't hateful or even angry, but fearful for the lives of everyone aboard and in her wake. I felt the weight of that burden in his admonishment, the responsibility he takes in his crew. That's great. I remember that.
He was wrong, but sure.
And Paul Gregory says, Saru, always the bridesmaid, never the bride, the character.
Aww.
I'm telling you, I think that's going to be a theme. He's going to keep getting close to that captaincy. It's going to be yanked out.
Justice for Saru. That's what I need in season 3. And the return of Lorca. Those two things. Those two things.
He dead.
he's in the mycelial network somewhere, I'm telling you. They're going to pull him out of there, and he's going
to
be good.
Speaking of mycelial, we need to talk about Stamets soon.
Except our next episode will not be Stamets. It will be who I consider my Star Trek doppelganger, Tilly!
Oh, yeah.
That's right. In 2 weeks, we'll be talking about Tilly.
Can we have a mature, appropriate discussion about Tilly?
Why not? Maybe.
Of course.
I mean, just because this is a group that I'm asking. Let's be thoughtful.
Why are you looking at me? What did I do here? Hey, folks, thank you so much for checking out our episode. We want to remind you once again that you guys can help support this podcast if you're loving what you're hearing. Over at patreon.com, go to patreon.com/StarTrekPod and make a per episode pledge. That means you're going to give us $2 an episode, $3, $5, $1 million an episode. And in exchange, if you give at least $2 an episode, you gain access to our exclusive Slack channel where we are all discussing. We got a ton of great people there, all big Trekkies, loving Star Trek and discussing every episode, doing rewatches of stuff. Meanwhile, we're also doing our own bonus exclusive episodes where Mike and Mariah are doing a Best of 7 series where they're talking about this character 7 of 9. I don't know if you've heard of her. Then we're also watching some of the Star Trek movies, and Mike made me watch the 5th one, which was painful. There's a lot of great content. Patreon.com/StarTrekPod. Thank you for all of your support.
I warned you about those whales.
He liked the whale.
The whales were great. We love the whales.
What does a god need with a starship?
If you enjoyed our bantering about Star Trek, our debate about Captain C, and you want to know more, if you're excited about us talking about Tilly and Stamets and everybody else, you know what? Why don't you share that? And check us out on Twitter at Star Trek Pod. Tweet about this episode, share it. As Mariah said earlier, sharing is caring. And follow us also on Instagram at Star Trek Pod.
Thank you so much for joining us on Star Trek Discovery Pod. Remember to visit StarTrekPod.co to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you get podcasts. Clyde, where can we follow you online and hear more from you?
You can follow me on Twitter at Clyde Haynes, and you can find me and all my other podcasts on the web, www.keyandclyde.com. That's KEIandClyde.com.
Mariah.
And I'm at Mariah Gossett on all social channels. That's Mariah with a Y and a Gossett with two S's and two T's.
Grant Davis.
Don't follow me. Leave me alone.
At Baron Von Grant Trolls. Follow me on Twitter at Mike Moody. Live long and prosper.
Bye.
Later.